30,000-year history of the relationship between climate and civilization. That teaches us some powerful lessons, doesn't it? Maybe. Up next, Brian Fagan will take your calls on Coast to Coast AM. And welcome back to Coast, George Norrie back with Brian Fagan. Brian, you say that climate change may have started, really started with man-made climate change about 200 years ago. But have we learned anything from that?
We've learned a great deal. We are, if you go back, for example, on urban pollution with coal heating and coal fires, cities in Europe, like London, for example, were plagued with horrible pollution from coal fires and really devastating fogs. I remember when I was a kid, I once was in London during one of these pea soup fogs, which were made famous by Sherlock Holmes, of course, with his descriptions. It was unbelievable. You could smell it. You could literally touch it. The visibility was 10 feet at times, and it was just utterly horrible. That is now gone because they've got rid of that sort of heating.
Yeah.
In fact, complaints about that sort of pollution go right back to Samuel Pepys in the 17th century, John Evelyn, the diarist. It's been going on a long time. So there's been a concern over pollution, like there was a concern over sanitation in Paris and London from the 17th to 18th and 19th centuries. So it's nothing new. What is new today is the scale of what has been done.
What was the year without a summer? What was that?
The year without summer was the year 1816, which was the year after the eruption of the Tambora volcano in Southeast Asia, which incidentally had erupted on a huge scale, much larger scale than this, 70,000 years ago. And this caused ash to go up into the atmosphere in enormous quantities, and this shut down the sun, and it didn't shut it down, it obscured it, and Europe had a very wet and cold summer, as did indeed much of North America. The American colonists suffered, among others. And in Europe, there was a lot of suffering. There was famine, there was hunger, and it's most famous, of course, for Mary Shelley, who was the wife of an English poet who was holed up in a villa in Switzerland on holiday, and she sat down and wrote one of the great famous novels of the 19th century, Frankenstein.
Ah, that's right.
So that's why it's mainly famous. It was a major event which rippled right across the world with consequences. Volcanoes have been a major factor in climatology, and it's only recently that we've really begun to realize this.
And they could be planet killers too, can't they?
They what? Sorry?
They could be planet killers too.
Oh, yes. They can really give us a lot of trouble. It's interesting that there have been waves of volcanoes. We're in a quiet period of volcanoes at the moment, but there have been major ones. There was a major one in 1680 in the Peru, which, again, had worldwide implications. The biggest one in recent years has been Mount Helens, of course, which is famous.
Yes.
And that's still having effects. So, yeah, we are very vulnerable to climate change of all sorts.
They're talking about the climate possibilities of the volcano at the Canary Islands at La Palma. And if that really goes, it could create a tsunami that could flood the coasts, the eastern seaboard of the United States.
It could cause major tsunamis. It could cause serious problems in the atmosphere and result in us having a colder weather for a year or so. All kinds of things. I haven't really followed it because I've been doing other things, but it sounds as if it has the potential to be pretty serious.
Yeah, it does. It's calmed down a little bit. They were really getting scared last week, so let's keep our fingers crossed.
All you need, excuse me, is a huge explosion, and these things happen.
They do indeed. Let's take some calls here for you. Eric in Indianapolis, welcome to the show. Hello, Eric.
Hello, George. How are you today?
Okay, my friend. Thank you.
Great. Thank you. great guest on tonight. I got a real question for you tonight.
Alrighty.
What caused the great flood during when Noah built the ark? Was that human error, or has anybody really studied on that?
What do you think of that one, Brian?
Noah's flood?
The flood of Noah.
The flood of Noah. That's a very interesting story. Here you get tangled up with issues of religious faith. And the best evidence for it is the fact that, in fact, floods of extensive scale were quite common in Mesopotamia between the Tigris and the Euphrates. And the floods in the two rivers were alternate between relatively minor to being really catastrophic. And really, probably, most likely, the Noah's flood is a folk memory of one of these floods. It just happens to have got famous because it got stuck into Genesis. And it's very interesting because there was a famous British archaeologist back in the 1930s who dug a pit into a city mound at Ur of the Chaldees in Iraq, and at the bottom he found a flood level, and he claimed that this was the biblical flood. In fact, it's much earlier than that. So it's really a folk memory of chronic flooding in the Mesopotamian area. Interestingly, you're from Indianapolis. I did a podcast or an interview with Indianapolis early today.
That's a great town. By the way, somebody tipped Noah off, though, right?
Somebody what?
Tipped him off.
Noah off. Well, there you're embarking into religious faith, my dear sir. It's a folk memory.
Well, how did he know how to build the ark, or did he?
That is folk memory. It's one of these things where you have these oral traditions, and I must confess I am not a man of faith, but these things come up, and how did humanity survive this? And it got built up into the big thing. There may literally have been a village where people did survive by getting into a boat,
mm-hmm.
which got enlarged. I have no idea.
And maybe he had the wisdom to build it. Who knows? I'm not sure he brought every animal on the boat.
I mean, one of the fascinating things of history is these sort of stories. I mean, how do you get all the animals in the mammalian family into one boat?
Exactly. Maybe he scientifically had their DNA instead, right?
Or maybe he fed them all butter and they got fat.
Maybe. Let's go to Perry in Aurora, Colorado. Hi, Perry. Welcome to the program.
Thank you, George. First-time caller.
Thank you, Perry.
I'm enjoying the conversation greatly. Brian, I would like to ask you if you have heard of and have considered and factored in the approximately 11,000-year planetary cycle of the Milankovitch cycles and their influence on the Earth and its temperature.
Milankovitch was a remarkable scientist, and when he wrote that, and I must confess at once that I don't know much about Milankovitch. I learned about it in college, but he developed these cycles, as you say, of about 11,000 years, and this was denied by a lot of people, but it's become fashionable again. And one of the things behind this is the fact that if we follow his cycles, we are going to, at some point, go into another cold glaciation, an ice age. And many people have believed that this ice age, in fact, would be coming in the next few thousand years, but anthropogenic global warming seems to have thrown the equation right off. So probably Milankovitch is off the table. But it is a fascinating theory, and there is some validity in it in terms of earlier periods of climatology.
All right, next up, let's go. Thank you, Perry. Let's go to Sandra in Orange County, California. First-time caller for Sandra. Hi, Sandra.
Hello.
Hi.
Thank you for taking my call, George.
Glad you got through.
It's a pleasure to chat with you as well as Brian.
Thank you.
It's kind of off of the subject a little bit. First of all, I turned on to the station a little bit late. Are you an anthropologist or an archaeologist?
Me?
Yes, you.
Ultimately.
Not me.
I was educated at Cambridge University in England in archaeology and some anthropology. I then spent 7 years in Africa doing a lot of archaeology and anthropology, and also developing an interest in multidisciplinary history. So I think what I really am is an anthropological archaeologist with an interest in interdisciplinary history, but my primary focus is, in fact, archaeology.
All right. Go ahead, Sandra.
Okay. Well, I wanted to say how interesting. I love all things, you know, I love history and a lot of old things. In fact, I've been working on a family tree, and I asked, when I called in, I asked the lady, I said, I have the same last name as you, which is Fagan. And I said, how does he spell that? I say, I spell mine F-A-G-A-N. And she said, you spell it the same way. So I just find it interesting. And I was wondering, have you ever done any, you know, genealogy or anything of checking your history and all of that?
Very interesting. I'm adopted.
Oh, really?
Which, of course, complicates everything. My wife has done a great deal of genealogy. She tracked down my birth mother, and I was born as a result of a rape, apparently. But my adopted family, my father was a publisher, believe it or not. My grandfather was a very prominent official in the British Raj in India, which I find always disconcerts New York Indian cab drivers. But basically, I am genetically very English, but I really don't have a genealogical history, unfortunately.
Did you ever, Brian, meet your biological mother?
No. She indicated she wanted no personal contact, although she was glad we were okay.
I've never understood how a parent could do that, even after so many years, but...
No, it's very complex. This was a complex situation, and I think it was daughter, was very angry that we contacted her.
Really?
We contacted them through the Salvation Army.
That would have been probably your half-sister, right?
I guess.
Yeah?
Yeah.
Most likely.
But anyway, no, we've had no contact. They live in central London, actually, in central England. My birth mother has, in fact, now died.
Right, absolutely. Well, you're 85. She's would have been over 100 at least, probably.
Oh, she was pretty aged at the time.
Walter in Pennsylvania. Take it away, Walt.
Hi, George.
Hi, Walter.
George, Dr. Fagan seems to be saying the opposite of what Mr. Gorham said a few nights ago. Mr. Gorham might say, well, the climate, by definition, has always changed throughout geologic history, which is correct. And I agree with much of what Dr. Fagan is saying now. As I said on the show previously, neither side is 100% correct, in my opinion. But I think that, you know, it's just common sense, George, that the human population of the planet cannot increase ad infinitum. There's got to be logically a limitation to it ecologically. George, I said to Gina that, you know, one of the things we can do is try to get away from this fixation we have on maintaining these golf green lawns, George. You know, when you maintain a lawn, you might as well have a parking lot from an ecologic standpoint, because when you mow the lawn, it pollutes the air and whatnot. So, George, we have to plant trees. The great, process of photosynthesis unites carbon dioxide and water, and it turns that into wood, George. So that is a great cooling element for our planet.
Well, we do plant a lot of trees. Why do you say that your lawn, though, is a polluter? Why? Explain that.
Well, George, obviously your lawnmower is much like an automobile. It has a motor on it and whatnot. At least the, you know, the power lawnmower.
The power ones, not the mower, not the rotary pushes.
And, you know, George, see, you know, we talk about CO2 as a warming element, but also water. Water has a very high specific heat. It is a source. It is a storage molecule of heat. And when you, the less water that we have in the atmosphere and in literally, you know what I mean? I'm talking about the, they talk about the sea level. So the less water we have, it also cools the planet.
Well, so you really can't control the water. We're in a drought situation in California now, right now, anyways, Brian, aren't we?
We are indeed. And that 10 years ago, we whipped out our loans. We have drought-resistant landscaping, and our water bill just collapsed. It was lovely.
What do you think of planting trees? We do that.
Oh, yeah. We have trees. That's a good thing.
What about these forest fires, these wildfires?
The wildfires you're dealing with, it's very fascinating because there's a growing field of research. I'm getting a rather indirect reply here. Where they're now realizing that Native Americans and Australian Aborigines and other indigenous groups had extraordinarily skilled and nuanced view of controlled burning. They did it to clear undergrowth, to encourage game, to encourage growth, and it was remarkably successful. And a lot of scholars now are beginning, ecologists, are beginning to look at the practices of, say, the Hopi Indians, of traditional Native American societies, and the way they handled fire. Because the big litany until recently with fire has been, oh, you must suppress any fire activity. In fact, there was a National Park, Forest Service policy, I believe, until quite recently, that all fires were to be suppressed by 10 a.m., which, of course, was nonsense. But the suppression is one of the reasons they're having so much trouble with a lot of the big fires, is because the undergrowth is not burnt.
Are we learning our lessons from our ancestors, in your opinion?
No, we're not. We are some. They're listening more and more because the real issue of issues is the fact that we are humans. We are Homo sapiens. We are people who are brilliant at cooperation, at thinking, at planning. And we also place a very strong emphasis on kinship, relationships, cooperation, and so on. And one of the most striking things about the recovery from Hurricane Katrina, from the recovery from Superstorm Sandy, from the new hurricane today, they're down in that area this year, is that the most powerful weapons we have as humans, I'm not talking about governments, is the very close relationships with family, with neighborhoods, with communities, with churches, with nonprofits, because these ties transcend a lot of political things and are of enormous value for local recovery, because a great deal of adaptation to climate isn't government and international, it's local.
Well, that is true. We're going to take a quick break, Brian, and come back and take final calls with you in a moment on Coast to Coast AM. We'll be back in a moment with final calls with Brian Fagan as we talk about his work, Climate Chaos. Next hour, Michael Litchens joins us as we'll talk about encounters with angels. And, of course, we'll open up the phone lines to get your angelic miracle stories as well on Coast to Coast. And welcome back to Coast, George Norrie with you, Brian Fagan. Our final segment here is book Climate Chaos. Where do people get your book Climate Chaos, Brian?
Say again?
Where do people get your book?
It's in the bookstores, it's with Amazon, it's the normal outlets, it's all over the place.
Great, super. And what's your next project?
I have a proposal in with a New York publisher. I'm not allowed to talk about it.
Okay.
But it does involve marginally climate. I'm sorry, I'm not allowed to say anything.
I understand indeed.
But so, I'm not finished yet. I've got one more book in me, at least.
Are you hopeful for our future, based on the things you know?
Yes. I am extremely optimistic, because we're human beings, and we haven't changed. But it is going to require a considerable amount of determination, and it's going to need us to think much more in the long term than we ever have in history, which is terribly important. I mean, the Netherlands are the classic example. I mean, will humankind survive? If the record of the past is any guide, we shall. But we will need to adapt, or perhaps be forced to adapt. There will be numerous challenges, almost certainly with violence and numerous casualties. The past reminds us that we're ingenious and innovative, capable of rising to trials that are far greater than those of ancient times. When we look back, we can now, in ways as we can now, in ways previously not possible, we can see what worked and what did not.
But most
important of all, it is clear that we need to unite and cooperate as a species. We will survive, and the reason we will is because we've achieved an understanding of the complex relationships between humanity and the world's ever-changing climate. As we said earlier, the past is not a foreign country. It's part of all of us and holds the keys to our future. That's the last paragraph in the book, and I think it sums it up.
Is the past also a glimpse into the future if things don't change?
No, and yes and no, because the past is very different because our world is so much more complex. What has not changed is human nature, the way we behave, the way we act. I, for a while, was working on a series of lectures on ancient emergencies. That was Pompeii and the eruption there like that. And the thing that really struck me was how very little our behavior has changed in the face of crisis, in the face of emergencies. And in fact, I gave a lecture to a large audience of first responders, emergency preparedness people. And at the end, somebody got up and said, "My God, I hadn't thought of that. We haven't changed," and they're right. And the same applies here.
Let's go back to the phones. Joel, west of the Rockies in Seattle, welcome to the show. Joel, go ahead, sir.
Hey, George. Hey, Brian.
Hi.
So to your point, Brian, earlier about the complexity of supply chains these days, at the beginning of the pandemic, we started seeing some cracks in, like, our agricultural supply chains, you know, things like milk getting dumped out and everything. And it seems like companies have been kind of trading off resiliency for productivity and extra profits. And it seems like that kind of puts us at risk for climate change coming up. And I don't know if you have any thoughts on ways to...
No, you're absolutely right.
Go ahead, Brian.
We were very vulnerable to disruptions in the supply chain. I mean, you've only got to look at motor cars today, or you've got to look at food. And there's no question at all that climate change is highly disruptive. It's also very disruptive when you have to deal with the issue of feeding people who can no longer feed themselves. And you're not talking about hundreds of people. You're talking about millions. And these are some of the greatest challenges for the future.
And, of course, you have to water them too, don't you?
You do indeed, yes. And in many places there isn't enough water. India is a classic case because the water table is just falling because it's been so exploited. We have the same problem here where I live. They've promiscuously allowed people to dig wells, and the result is that the water table has been really decimated.
It's depleted, to be sure. The Colorado River is sinking, going down, down,
indeed,
and down.
That's another one, yes.
And that's a big problem. Let's go next to Dave in Albany, New York. David, thank you for calling. Go ahead, Dave.
Yeah, thanks for having me on, George.
Sure thing.
Brian, I want to just touch two subjects, and then, you know, but the first one is, you know, we had the cleanest stacks in the world, you know, scrubbers and everything, to keep the least emissions down on coal. But that does not hold true with China and India. And I even, you know, I've heard that they're, you know, building or in the process of 2,000 coal plants around the world, including 56 in Vietnam, which kind of like that kind of like threw me back, you know, that specific 56 of them in Vietnam. So I don't see, you know, when you see the forest fires and all the carbon dioxide that's going up in the air with them, I mean, and then they're going to put diapers on cows and stuff. Are you kidding me? You know, we've put so much carbon dioxide, or I say we, but the forest fires have, that, you know, having people try to stop using, exactly, you know, carbon dioxide or making it or whatever is ridiculous.
We have the other thing I'd like
to, yeah, the other thing I'd like to talk about, though, is Fukushima, you know, the gift that keeps on giving. That doesn't stop. That's going China syndrome. So all that stuff, all that radiation's coming onto the West Coast. And we used to be able to watch how much what the radiation levels were, but they don't want you to do that anymore. But it was quite interesting. I mean, it was even showing up in the cow's milk out in Vermont out here, you know. So I hate to be a pessimist, but, you know, I just don't see things as, you know, I hope you're right.
All right, react to that, Brian.
No, absolutely. What's going on is a huge mass denial of the fact that the greatest challenge we face is that of climate change. We've done it to ourselves, and now we've got to unravel it. And are the politicians showing many signs of looking at it? Hell no. All they want to be is reelected. I get very cynical about politics for that reason.
Are we going to win this battle, though? That's the question.
Yes, we are.
You feel that way?
We've got to.
We have no choice, do we?
Exactly. And this is one of the few times in life that we really have got no choice.
Does it get worse before it gets better?
Oh, with no question.
Next up, we go to Portland, Oregon. Nicole's with us. Hello, Nicole. Welcome.
Hi, George. I'm the insider, and I listen all the time.
Well, thank you.
Hey, I wanted to bring up, wasn't it William Reich that created Orgone Energy, and wasn't there some sort of a tool that they used or that they found that they could manipulate the weather as far as, like, the forest fires go and India and all these places that need water?
There may be. Brian, what do you think of that?
I don't know anything about this at all.
Okay.
It's just outside my knowledge base.
A couple years ago in China, they had the Olympics, and they said to China, what about the weather? Aren't you concerned about it? They said, no, we control the weather.
No, well, that's just hype from the People's Republic, I would imagine.
Let's go
Nobody
back to Nicole for a question.
Weather.
Go ahead, Nicole.
Also, I mean, I really feel like, you know, the $2 trillion that we spent over 20 years in Afghanistan and the $86 million of top-of-the-line equipment that we left over there, I really feel like if we were applying our money to more important things, we would be able to do the things that we need to do, the desalinization, the power grid, things like that.
No, there's no question about it. We have spent our money in the wrong places. And, Brian, I agree with her there.
We never learn. We never, never learn. It's like this recent recall election in this state.
That did not work.
The state had to waste $270 million. Can you imagine what we could have done with that money?
And California needs that kind of money.
It does.
My gosh.
Yeah.
Let's go to Tacoma, Washington.
You're absolutely right, Nicole. You're absolutely right. I couldn't agree more.
Samuel, take it away.
Hello there.
Hi, Sam.
Hey, Brian, I had a question for you regarding it. I guess you would call it a conspiracy theory. Have you ever heard of the mud flood?
The mud slud?
I
have not. The mud slud.
So what the mud flood basically, what the conspiracy theory is that there was a big flood and things started over about 100 years ago. So the buildings we see now that we think are 100 to 200 years old are actually thousands of years old. And there was a really advanced civilization prior to that, kind of like the flood with Noah, like the previous listener spoke about.
How the hell do people come up with this garbage?
Now, Brian, it's all just a conspiracy theory.
Yeah, and I'm sick and tired of these damn things because they are obviously useless, they are not helpful, and are just downright nonsense.
Some of them might be true.
Don't get me going on this.
But some of them could be true.
No, not many of them.
Well, how about the one that the Sphinx is much older than they said it was?
Nope, that's nonsense.
They see rainwater erosion on it.
They've proved it beyond any reasonable doubt. However, there will be people out there who will believe that the Sphinx was created by whatever and that this, that, and the other. And there's nothing you can do that will change their minds.
How'd they make the pyramids with those large blocks of stone that we can't even move today?
There's a great deal of information on that. There's been some very fascinating research done over the last 20 years. There's an entire pyramid construction town that has now been found, and they in fact have figured out how the people moved the boulders. It's fascinating. They use ramps. It's really fascinating stuff, all with very, very sophisticated archaeology.
Up next, Greg in northern New Jersey. Hi, Greg. Thank you for calling. Go ahead.
Good morning, gentlemen. Two facts. Yesterday in Australia, they're coming out of their winter into their summer, and there was a place where it's 120 degrees.
Oh, that's hot.
That's hot, and they're just going into their summer. Another fact, in Great Britain, at the height of the pollution in the industrial age in 1850, the average age of an industrial worker was 38. I mean, all I can say is right now in our country, how do we say this? There's a couple people making a hell of a lot of money that are just brainwashed that this is all great pollution and all that stuff. Started with the idiot Reagan and the moron who was in the last, Trump, who, you know, those of us in the New York area know better than what an idiot he was, especially with the environment. I mean, Pope Francis has spoken against this. You have the Patriarch of Constantinople, Bartholomew, for decades talking about this. The best scientists in the world. And we're going to sacrifice humanity and our kids and our grandkids in the future for a couple of people to have yachts? I have to ask, Mr. Fagan, did the recent, historically, if you will, notice of all this take place with von Humboldt around 1805 when he was observing places around the world with pollution?
Now, what's your question there, Greg?
My question, the real beginning of noticing the pollution, the causes of pollution, began with Alexander von Humboldt when he took his journeys to South America, I believe, around 1805, 1805.
Oh, yeah, he was a very early person who did it. A lot of people noticed it. It goes back to the 17th century or even earlier than that. And in fact, some Romans complained.
But I don't think anybody ever thought anything could happen.
No. That was just an evil you lived with, like everything else. Like the evil of smallpox, people lived with that, you know.
Jim in Hawaii, first-time caller. Go ahead, Jim.
Good evening, George. Good evening, Brian.
Hi there.
It's a pleasure to talk to you both, and an honor. I've got kind of a comment/question. I agree with you about the desalination plants. You know, that can provide water for millions.
Yep.
And I've got an idea about how the Arctic and the Antarctic, the ice is all melting. I've got, I guess, a harebrained idea for a few years to try to help save it. That and the coral that's being bleached between, like, here in Hawaii, Australia, and other places.
Well, the coral's being eroded away. We've only got a minute left here, Brian, and we've got to do something about our coral reefs because they are quickly plundering away.
Oh, indeed, and the world in 50 years is going to be very different to what it is now. And you got me scared because I'm going to Joshua Tree in 10 days.
I'll be there next June, probably. So you take care, Brian. Keep in touch with us, okay?
Yeah, I will.
All right, thank you. That's Brian Fagan. His book is called Climate Chaos. Up next, Michael Litchens joins us. One of his works is called Encounters with Angels. So that'll tell you what we'll be talking about here on Coast to Coast. Hey, and don't forget to sign up for our free YouTube channel. If you haven't already, just go to YouTube, type in Coast to Coast AM Official, and hit the subscribe button. There's no charge for that. We'll be back in a moment on Coast to Coast AM.